Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, we've talked about the death of fiat money many times in this series, but there is a version, perhaps, where on its road to its death, it actually strengthens. Imagine, if you will, daft government overspending faces off against Obi-Wan Dollar, and Obi-Wan Dollar says, strike me down, but I'll become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. Now, to explain what's going on there, we've got Brent Johnson of Santiago Capital. Brent, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. This should be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're very well known for the dollar milkshake theory. Can you tell us what that is? And also a side question to that is, do you actually like the answer that you got from your own theory?
Two good questions. So first of all, the theory is that for many reasons, some of them deserved and some of them undeserved, the United States dollar, while perhaps it is a horrible currency overall, it's better than all the others. And for many, many reasons, as we move forward in time and the debts become a bigger problem and, you know, geopolitical discourse tends to fall, I think the dollar would get stronger. And as a result, the United States and the US dollar itself would suck up capital from the rest of the world. And so while the dollar may lose value against real things, it would gain substantially against all of its fiat peers. And the reason is because the entire world has an incredible amount of US dollar debt. It's not just the United States. I think everybody knows the United States owes something like $37 trillion. And that's if you just include the national debt. If you include corporate and, you know, other obligations, it's probably $100 trillion. But what most people don't know is that the rest of the world owes an equal amount in US dollars, and they can't print it to serve it. And so as it gets stronger, it causes them a lot of pain. And when it causes them a lot of pain, you know, bad things happen to their economies. They have to print even more of their local currency to deal with it, which makes their local currency fall even more. And so the theory is that while fiat may come to an end, it's a rising dollar versus its peers that brings fiat to an end, not a falling dollar. And so if you see the DXY falling or the dollar euro rate falling, that's an indication that the system is working, that the system is perpetuating itself. It's only when it goes higher that things start to break and we get real de-dollarization, because it's forced de-dollarization via defaults and a lot of pain. And the short answer to your second question is no, I don't like the result that I came up with. And in fact, when I kind of figured this out, I don't know, 6-7 years ago now, part of the reason I knew I was on the right track is I hated the answer. I didn't think it was fair. I didn't think it was right, so to speak. But every time I just took off my biased wants and desires and just looked at the cold hard facts of it, this is the answer I kept coming back to. And in my business, which is the investing business, you kind of have to treat the world as it is, not as you want it to be. And so that's what the milkshake theory was or is, and that's kind of my thoughts on it.
So, I mean, you said something interesting there. You talked about how a rising dollar, that feels more like the end game of this, but a falling dollar is I don't know, re-dollarization or something. That is I mean, I suppose the mechanism there is that if the dollar is falling, it's because of the rest of the world is generating these dollar-denominated debts, which is feeding into this system, which is extending it.
That's correct. So in the type of system that we currently have, and this is globally, it's not just in the United States, money is loaned into existence. So, you know, the central bank of the United States can create reserves, but they don't create the loans that then create deposits that then create demand for the money. And the interesting thing is that 50 years ago, when the United States went off the gold standard, there was probably a brief period of time where the rest of the world could have decided to reject the dollar and move back to gold on its own or some kind of other hard-backed, commodity-backed money. But they didn't. And in the period of time that they didn't do that, the United States, you know, came to an agreement with Saudi Arabia that they would price all their oil in dollars. And that forced the rest of the world to once again need dollars. And rather than fight it, it actually turbocharged what's known as now the euro dollar market. So dollar denominated credit, dollar denominated transactions, dollar denominated savings, however you want to describe dollars that exist outside the United States, those are called euro dollars. And with the on-ramp of the Saudi Arabia oil for dollars scheme, it turbocharged the growth of that euro dollar market. And in the subsequent 50 years, that's what's led to all of this, you know, euro dollar credit based in US dollars that sits outside the United States. And I should say that those euro dollar loans and credit that's been, that is not owed to the United States. So if it were to be defaulted on, they're not defaulting on the United States. They're defaulting on each other because it's the rest of the world transacting with each other in US dollars. So if somehow that debt were defaulted on, they would be defaulting on the asset of one of their other non-US entity peers. And that's where this pain would come from. And I would argue that would be de-dollarization.
I suppose the implication of that is that there's, if these are dollars that are not going to impact the US, therefore the US doesn't necessarily feel under any obligation to bail out this system.
That's right. Well, I wouldn't say there's no obligation, but they're going to bail out themselves before they bail out the rest of the world. So that there would be an order in which the bailouts would happen. And there is no obligation that they have to bail out the rest of the world. Now, they typically have. But I think Trump coming into power changes that calculus a little bit. I'm not saying that he won't do it, but it's perhaps not as certain as it was before. And there's actually been many articles, many interviews given on this exact topic where European monetary authorities are worried about the amount of dollar credit that exists in the European banking system, the exposure to US dollars, and the fear that the US may not provide the liquidity in dollars that they typically have.
So I'm glad you touched on the euro dollar market, because I wanted to come to that. And just for the audience, euro dollars has nothing to do with the currency of the euro. It's dollar obligations that are created somewhere else, such as in Europe. That's the name euro dollars. I think a lot of these obligations are actually created in London. That's a very big market for these things. But it literally just means dollar-denominated obligations that are created anywhere outside of the US. That's the euro-dollar market. But okay, given the euro-dollar market, it gives the US a sort of permanent free lunch card that allows them to get away with ever higher deficits, this easy issuance of debt, and then what that, the effect of that down the line is that it ends up exporting the value chain, because you need to run this system where something of value is produced outside the US. The US produces pieces of paper with the president's face on, dollars, and then they swap them over, which implies that the rest of the world is always going to be able to find a way to create value outside. And so effectively what you're doing is you're exporting the productive part of your economy outside of the US in order so that this cycle can continue. You can keep swapping dollars for it. It sounds great at first, but if you look at it, it's perhaps more like a Faustian pact. It's like the US founders of the sort of post-war Bretton Woods systems. signed up to this Faustian pact where it's like, okay, we will have whatever it is, 50 years, 75 years of being able to have enormous hegemony, run whatever deficits we like. But the cost is that all of your productive value chain is going to get moved outside of the US. So it's great for the US, but only up to a point.
I think that's right. And I think we've reached the point where at least one guy that we all are aware of named Donald Trump has said enough is enough. And I think there's enough people in the United States who agreed with him that said enough is enough. And that's why he became president. And so going back to your point that there is no obligation for the US to supply this credit to the rest of the world, I think that is probably, I don't know if it's going to stop, but it's perhaps not going to be provided as easily as it once was. And where there may have been some covert strings attached to that, you know, given liquidity in the past, I think those strings will now be overtly stated and very publicly stated in some cases. And that process of moving back, so the pendulum swung all that way, and as it now swings back, I don't think that that will be a, let's just call it a non-volatile process. I think it will be a very volatile process. And I think it is a problem for the United States. And so I don't want people to think that I am Pollyannish about the effects of the United States. That's not the whole point of the theory. The theory is that the United States will still get hurt, but the rest of the world will, in my opinion, get hurt more than the United States in this volatile process. Because while the U.S. has many of the same problems that the rest of the world has, the U.S. has many advantages that the rest of the world does not have. And the perhaps the biggest one is the ability to print liquidity, which is the point that you just made. No one else has the ability to print the liquidity. So let me give you an example. Let's use 2022 as an example, because that was a fairly extreme year with regard to interest rates. In 2022, the Federal Reserve took interest rates from basically 0 to 5% over a 9-month period. I don't want to say it had never happened before in history, but it's certainly one of the fastest tightenings of monetary policy in history. And during that time period, the U.S. struggled a little bit. You know, markets were off 20-30% during that time period. There was a lot of volatility. There was a lot of uncertainty. The interest rates started to rise on the long end as well. And so that was going to cost more to finance the U.S. debt. But in that same year, Italy's bond yields blew out so much that the ECB had to set up a special facility to buy Italian bonds. The Bank of England had to bail out their gilt market because it was collapsing. The Bank of Japan had to bail out both the yen market and their government bond market. And that was the year where China's real estate collapse really picked up speed. And that can all be very highly correlated to the rising dollar, because the dollar went from, the DXY index went from, I don't know, let's call it 102 to 112 over a 6-month period. And that caused a lot of chaos in the world. And the US is the one who was able to take the pressure off. No one else could take the pressure off themselves. It was ultimately when Powell stopped raising rates and they started saying that we've probably tightened enough and now we will, you know, be looking to potentially ease at some point. That's when everybody was able to take a breath. And I would argue, and I have argued this several times, that while the raising of interest rates by the United States was certainly done in order to combat the rampant inflation that was causing political problems domestically, I think it was also done, or at least it was known that doing it would cause problems for the rest of the world, and it would put the rest of the world under a lot of pressure. And it's a way for the U.S. to re-exert their hegemony, you know, and set up new deals and, you know, make everybody choose a side, for lack of a better way of saying it. And, you know, I think it was a reminder to the world, at least the financial authorities, that there's there's one central bank that sits above all others, and it's not even close. And again, I don't necessarily like this, but this is reality of the way the system's designed.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on Trump there. I'd be interested to get your opinion on the recent tariff situation, because when that occurred, my thinking on it was, okay, yes, there is the manufacturing argument about bringing that on shore. That was the domestic narrative that was played out, because that was the one that had the strongest support. There was also the military procurement argument, which is, okay, look, the US should have the option to be able to fire a missile at China without that missile supply chain being dependent on China. So I get that element as well. But another big element, which wasn't really talked about anywhere outside of a small financial circle, was that the US had a strong need to get the dollar down. And the reason for that is that this year in particular, a little bit of next year, the US has a big need for liquidity. It's got a lot of debt to recycle overwards. And if the rest of the world was choking because the dollar was too high and it's got all of its dollar debt, then that means it can't refinance that debt without absorbing most of its capacity. But if the dollar comes lower, that frees up capacity that can then, after they've done their debt, their dollar-denominated debt, that liquidity can then flow back into the US, which will help the US. And so I thought at the time that a big unstated reason for it was a drive to get DXY lower. And it's kind of done exactly that. DXY went from something like 110 to whatever it is now, 97, something like that today. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that something that you see? And what was your whole take on the tariff thing?
So I do think there was some of that. And this is where what the Trump administration wants and what they get will probably end up being two different things, and also where some of their policies conflict with each other. But the short answer is yes, I do think they wanted, interest rates to come down. The interest rates haven't come down, but I think the dollar has come down in anticipation of the fact that they think interest rates will be coming down. So markets often move on anticipation, and Trump clearly wants lower interest rates, both on the short end and the long end. And part of the reason is because they do need to refinance all this debt. And it's easier to refinance the debt, especially to get foreigners to buy the debt, if the dollar is weaker, because if the dollar is weaker, their currency is stronger. That's one reason it's easier. And then it's also, if they can refinance at a lower interest rate, it saves them interest payments in the future. Now, one thing I would say with regard to this is, while it helps refinancing with interest rates being lower and the dollar weaker, I don't think it has to happen. In other words, I think the U.S. could still refinance at even higher rates. And while that would be a problem, I think it would be a bigger problem for the rest of the world. And I think for two reasons, because I think in many ways, and I know some people will not like me saying this, but I think in many ways, foreigners buying treasuries is a form of tribute to the king, right? Oh, now, yeah. It's not stated as such, but I think there is some behind the scenes. I think that's kind of what it is, or at least to a certain degree. And not only that, but I think the U.S. at the end of the day, the Fed could go back to doing QE if they wanted to. You know, they could drop rates to make it easier. They could buy the bonds that the Treasury is issuing. And I know many people will say, but yes, that will kill the dollar. Okay, well, maybe it will. But doesn't Trump want a lower dollar, right? But my point would be is if rates were higher and they had to refinance at higher rates, I would argue that the rest of the world would just have to deal with it. And they would have to buy those treasuries at higher rates. Because remember, the Treasury, U.S. treasuries and the U.S. dollar underlies the entire system. If you're going to operate on the global stage as it is today, and this could potentially change in the future, but if you want to act on the global stage today, you need dollars, and U.S. treasuries are the collateral off of which those dollars are loaned into existence. The other thing is if the U.S. has to refinance at these higher rates, yes, that's bad for the United States, but then the rest of the world gets priced off of the U.S. treasury. Now, perhaps not these other sovereigns, but global corporates get priced off of the U.S. 10-year rate. So if you've got a U.S. 10-year bond that's, let's say the interest rates go higher. Let's say the 10-year goes to 6%. It's pretty high. But what does a Brazilian corporate now have to pay to raise money, right? What does Turkey have to pay to raise money? What does Australia have to pay and Canada have to pay Canadian corporations to? Because if you can buy a treasury, which you have to have anyway, and it pays you 6%, you're going to need something paying higher than that to move out on the risk reward scale, right? Now, I'm not saying that treasuries are risk free. I think that's a misnomer that has been perpetuated, somewhat of a myth. But
well, I will have you know that I've done many financial exams where the correct answer to a question like that is yes, the dollar, the treasuries and gilts are risk free. That was the right answer to get through the exam.
No, and listen, and that's the thing is, like, is it ridiculous? Yes, it's ridiculous, but it's also the world in which we live, right? And I think it's important. And the other thing is, I think what people forget often, I deal with a lot of individuals. I deal mainly with retail investors. And I will often talk to people who will say, well, I would never buy a government bond yielding 5% because it will get inflated away. And that's fine. It's solid logic, but investing is not really about figuring out what you would do. Investing is about figuring out what the rest of the world's going to do, what their motivations, what their goals are. Why would they buy a treasury? And the fact is that banks around the world, they're not buying based on absolute value. They're buying based on a spread. They're going to buy a bond that pays them this much, 6%, and then they're going to pay their customer 4% or 3%, and they're going to make the spread. And that's a very simplistic example, but the point is I think oftentimes when people say the U.S. government cannot finance itself at 6%, they're basing it on the fact that they wouldn't buy the bond. But you need to do a better understanding of who else would buy the bond and why they would buy the bond and how many of the bonds they would buy. And I think once you start going down that road, you realize that while there's several problems that the U.S. has to deal with, you know, the rest of the world has those as well. And let me make one more point while I'm on this topic is that, you know, as interest rates rise, U.S. Treasury prices fall. Right. And so people will show the U.S. Treasury bond is no longer a store of value. And they'll say, well, what would happen if nobody bought the bonds? The bonds would crash. OK, let's play that out, because that is true. Is that singularly bad for the United States? Well, when you consider that every central bank in the world holds treasuries on their balance sheet, and every commercial bank around the world holds treasuries, not every bank, but most of them hold treasuries. If those treasuries now go to zero because nobody will buy them, then that means the balance sheets of those central banks and all of those commercial banks outside the United States are now impaired as well. And remember, the U.S. can recapitalize its balance sheet with a stroke of a pen, and the rest of the world cannot. So when you start looking at things on a relative basis rather than an absolute basis, I keep coming back to the conclusion that while it's not a good situation, I think the U.S. is better off, despite all its problems, than many of the other of its competitors.
Yeah. If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.